Hi, this is Katie. I'm reading from Philip Roth's The Ghostwriter, page 129 through 134. It was not so improbable, either, that after a long hospital convalescence, she had not made her way to the address in Switzerland where the family had agreed to meet if they should ever lose touch with one another. Would a weak 16-year-old girl undertake a journey requiring money, visas, requiring hope, only to learn at the other end that she was as lost and alone as she feared? No, the improbable part was this, that instead of telephoning time and saying, "I am the one who wrote the diary, find Otto Frank," she jotted down in her notebook the date on the magazine's cover, and after a tooth had been filled, went off with her school books to the library. What was improbable, inexplicable, indefensible, a torment still to her conscience, was that, calm and studious as ever, she checked the New York Times Index and the Reader's Guides to Periodical Literature for Frank Anne, and Frank Otto, and Het Atterhouse. And when she found nothing, went to the library's lowest stacks where the periodicals were shelved. There she spent the remaining hour before dinner rereading the article in Time. She read it until she knew it by heart. She studied her father's photograph, now 60, and those were the words that did it, made her once again the daughter who had cut his hair for him in the attic, the daughter who did her lessons there with him as her tutor, the daughter who would run to his bed, cling to him under the covers when she heard the Allied bombers flying over Amsterdam. Suddenly she was the daughter for whom he had taken the place of everything she could no longer have. She cried for a very long time. But when she went to dinner in the dormitory, she pretended that nothing catastrophic had once again had happened to Otto Frank's Anne. But then, right from the beginning, she had resolved not to speak about what she'd been through. Resolutions were her strong point as a young girl on her own. How else could she have lasted on her own? One of the thousand reasons she could not bear Uncle Daniel, the first of her foster fathers in England, was that sooner or later he wound up telling whoever walked into the house about all that had happened to Amy during the war. And then there was Miss Giddings, the young teacher in the school north of London who was always giving the orphan little Jewess tender glances during history class. One day after school, Miss Giddings took her for a lemon curd tart at the local tea room and asked her questions about the concentration camps. Her eyes filled with tears as Amy, who felt obliged to answer, confirmed the stories that she had heard, but could never quite believe. "Terrible," said Miss Giddings. "So terrible." Amy silently drank her tea and ate her lovely tart while Miss Giddings, like one of her own history students, tried in vain to understand the past. "Why is it," said the unhappy teacher, "that for centuries people have hated you Jews?" Amy rose to her feet. She was stunned. "Don't ask me that," the girl said. "Ask the madman who hate us." And she had nothing further to do with Miss Giddings as a friend, or with anyone else who asked her anything about what they couldn't possibly understand. One Saturday, only a few months after her arrival in England, vowing that she ever heard another plaintive Belson out of Uncle Daniel's mouth, she would run off to Southampton and stow away an American ship. And having had about enough of the snooty brand of sympathy the purebred English teachers offered at school, she burned her arm while ironing a blouse. The neighbors came running at the sound of her screams and rushed her to the hospital emergency room. When the bandage was removed, there was a patch of purple scar tissue about half the size of an egg instead of her camp number. After the accident, as her foster parents called it, Uncle Daniel informed the Jewish Welfare Board that his wife's ill health made it impossible for them to continue to have Amy in their home. The foster child moved on to another family, and then another. She told whoever asked that she'd been evacuated from Holland with a group of Jewish schoolchildren a week before the Nazis invaded. Sometimes she did not even say the schoolchildren were Jewish, an omission for which she was mildly rebuked by Jewish families who had accepted the responsibility for her and were troubled by her lying. But she could not bear all of them laying their helpful hands on her shoulders because of Auschwitz and Belsen. If she was going to be thought exceptional, it would not be because of Auschwitz or Belsen, but because of what she had made of herself since. They were kind and thoughtful people. They tried to get her to understand that she was not in danger in England. "You needn't feel frightened or threatened in any way," they assured her, "or ashamed of anything." "I'm not ashamed, that's the point." "Well, that isn't always the point when young people try and hide their Jewish origins. Maybe it isn't with others," she told them, "but it is with me." On Saturday, after discovering her father's photograph in Time, she took the morning bus to Boston, and in every foreign bookstore looked in vain for a copy of Het Atterhouse. 2 weeks later, she traveled 3 hours to Boston again, this time to the main post office to rent a box. She paid for it in cash and then mailed the letter she was carrying in her handbag. along with a money order for $15 to contract publishers in Amsterdam, requesting them to send Poche's page to Pilgrim International Bookshop, P.O. Box 152, Boston, Mass., USA, as many copies as $15 would buy of Het Escherhuis by Anne Frank. She had been dead to him for some 4 years, believing her dead for another month or two would not really hurt much more. Curiously, she did not hurt any more either, except in bed at night when she cried and begged forgiveness for the cruelty she was practicing on her perfect father, now 60. Nearly 3 months after she had sent the order off to her Amsterdam publisher, on a warm, sunny day in the beginning of August, there was a package too large for the Pilgrim Bookshop post office box waiting to be picked up in Boston. She was wearing a beige linen skirt and a fresh white cotton blouse, both ironed the night before. Her hair, cut in a pageboy style that spring, had been washed and set the previous night, and her skin was evenly tanned. She was swimming a mile every morning and playing tennis every afternoon, and all in all was as fit and energetic as a 20-year-old could be. Maybe that was why, when the postal clerk handed her the parcel, she did not tear at the string with her teeth or faint straight away onto the marble floor. Instead, she walked over to the common, the package mailed from Holland swinging idly from one hand, and wandering along until she found an unoccupied bench. She sat first on the bench in the shade, but then got up and walked until she found a perfect spot in the sunshine. After thoroughly studying the Dutch stamps, post-war issues new to her, and contemplating the postmark, she set about to see how carefully she could undo the package. It was a preposterous display of unruffled patience, and she meant it to be. She was feeling at once triumphant and giddy. Forbearance, she thought, patience. Without patience, there is no life. When she had finally untied the string and unfolded, without tearing, the layers of thick brown paper, it seemed to her that what she had so meticulously removed from the wrappings and placed onto the lap of her clean, pretty American girl's beige linen skirt was her survival itself. Van and Frank. Her book. Hers.